Hey, everybody, I got a great one today, and normally I'd add, and this time I mean it, but we got Andy Slavitt, and Andy Slavitt is always great, always great. And that's why this is his sixth podcast with me, but this time Andy's a big shot. You had to be a big shot, didn't you? I think that's right. Andy is now the senior advisor on the president's coronavirus task force. Now, he's been a big shot before. He was the acting administrator for Medicare and Medicaid, a $1 trillion agency during the last 2 years of the Obama administration, $1 trillion agency. He was head of the thing. If Andy had just skimmed one-thousandth of their budget, he'd be a billionaire. Think about that. But he didn't. But in the previous five times that Andy, I've had Andy on, he's been the former head of CMS, like I'm a former senator, so not such a big shot. But if you've heard him on the podcast before, you know he's an enormously knowledgeable, thoughtful, effective resource on the coronavirus. And every one of my previous podcasts with Andy has been among the rare great ones that we do. And now Andy's a big shot. He's working in the White House now. And you can tell right off the bat it's gone to his head, because when we recorded this a couple days ago, it was during his lunch break. And right off the bat, he asks, can I eat? Can I eat during the interview? And of course, I say, no, no, this isn't an audio medium. You can't hear someone's lips, you know, smacking during a podcast. And so less than 10 minutes into this, you'll hear Andy, while answering a question, you'll hear this. And I go, are you eating? And he says, yeah. And he's embarrassed. You'll hear it. You'll hear it. And then for the rest of the podcast, he does not eat. And so after we're done recording, Andy tells me what happened. He had a tub of cream cheese from some very popular deli in D.C. He had a little tub of candied salmon cream cheese, which sounds terrible to me, but he says it's unbelievably addictive. And Peter, you've had it, right?
I have had it.
And it's really good?
It's amazing. They take this salmon that they cure with like honey and some spices, and they mix it with cream cheese, and oh boy, is it good.
Well, anyway, what had happened is that while we were talking, Andy, during the interview, and he told me afterwards, that he had completely unconsciously stuck his finger in the tub and scooped up some cream cheese with the finger and was eating it when I caught him. And you'll hear him say on the podcast right after I bust him that he was blushing. And he told me that because he didn't realize he was eating, but he realized that not only was he eating, but he was doing something pretty disgusting. He stuck his finger in the cream cheese. But, and then, of course, he was actually not at the White House. He was a few blocks from the White House as apartment, and his wife Lana had to eat out of that same tub. Okay, we're done with that. Another thing you'll hear us talk about is something that I'm kind of obsessed with, which is the 95% effective figure that you hear about the Pfizer vaccine. And I know what that means, but no one knows what that means. No one I ask. When I ask friends, they don't know what it means. They think, do I have a 5% chance of getting the virus if I take the Pfizer vaccine? No, 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 no. It's much, much more minuscule than that. So I think it's really important for people to understand what the 95% figure means, what the Pfizer's 95% effective means. And I had Dr. Fauci explain it when he was here on the podcast a while ago, but I can't do this enough. This is very, very important. So I have Andy explain it, and he does a decent job. I asked him to explain. Then I take a shot at it. And frankly, I don't do a great job, and Andy gives me some crap for it, and I don't edit any of that out. You'll hear that. And I keep it in for two reasons. First, it's kind of funny. Also, it's just me and Peter. And frankly, you know, I often say this podcast is like the Daily without the resources of the New York Times. But this is so important, I want to take another shot at it, what this 95% effective figure means. Okay, so here it is. These vaccines are tested in a double-blind study. In the Pfizer double-blind study, there were two groups, as there always are. Those who got the placebo, now 21,830 people got the placebo. And those who got the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, also 21,830 people. In the study, in the placebo group, 162 got the virus, tested positive for the virus. In the Pfizer group, eight people is 5% of 162. That's where the 95% effective figure comes from. That's what that means. It's a comparison. Only 0.74% of the people in the placebo group got the virus, were infected by the virus. 162 is 0.74% of 21,830. Only 0.037% of the Pfizer folks got infected. Eight is 0.037% of 21,830. So only 5% as many folks in the Pfizer group got infected as in the placebo group. Hence, it's 95% effective compared to the placebo group. But it's unbelievably effective. And not only that, but the ones who get infected after they've taken the Pfizer vaccine, they don't get sick. That's the big deal here. And you'll hear Andy describe it because there's different levels of sick. There is getting a little bit of a fever, and then there's sicker. And you don't get sick. You don't get real sick. That's the thing. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is I just want everyone to take it. This is the polio vaccine. This is the smallpox vaccine. If everyone took this vaccine, we would get rid of the virus. If everyone in the world, everyone in the world. And there's a bit of a race here because when people don't take it, there's a chance for them to get infected. There's a chance for the virus to mutate. And there's a chance to develop a variant that the vaccine doesn't work on. So that's why. Now, I know if you're listening to this, you intend to get, if you haven't already gotten, the vaccine. But I just tell people this, especially the friends of yours who may be in that group that for some reason don't intend to take the vaccine. We know that 50% of male Republican voters don't intend to take the vaccine, and that is not just bad for them, it's bad for everybody. So I hope that explains that. I think you'll get a lot out of this conversation with Andy Slavitt. He really is a treasure. They're really working really hard in the Biden administration to do this right. And I think you'll enjoy this. It's a great one for a change.
Am I allowed to eat while we do this?
No.
I'm kidding.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I first did my Air America radio show, we did a few test shows, and I didn't really understand radio. And one of the things was in audio is don't eat. And Catherine Landfer, who's my co-host, chided me. And then we used to do a thing called mastication theater, where we'd have I'd be Dick Cheney eating, and Condoleezza Rice, she'd be Condoleezza Rice, and we'd be at a restaurant having a conversation. That was cute. It was cute. Well, you know, I'm nothing if not cute. Andy Slavitt is with me. Andy, I think this is you are now by far the most frequent guest on the Al Franken podcast.
That's nice. Nice to be back. Thank you for having me back.
Well, it's thank you for coming back, because now you're a big shot. What is your title? I don't even know your title. What's your title?
I'm the senior advisor for the COVID response in the White House.
That's a big job. I think you're doing a good job, by the way, you guys.
Well, thanks. It is a great team. I will say that. Whether we're doing a good job or not, I think we're on our way. We obviously have a lot of work to do, but it is the president has brought in people who are, they really know what they're doing, and that's nice to see. It's encouraging to be a part of. Everybody in the team has kind of been in situations like this before.
Well, Jeffrey Zients is heading up the task force. Is that correct?
Zients is the White House kind of czar, the COVID response coordinator. You've got Ron Klain, who's the chief of staff, so he's working on many other things, but he, as you know, and as you probably a lot of your listeners know, oversaw the Ebola response.
Right.
And one of the differences, I think, in this administration, you had Tony Fauci on, is that the scientists are really playing a prominent role. They're basically doing and saying everything that they believe. And so they're a big active part of the team, same with the career civil servants. So it's a much more, I think, unleashed effort than we've had before.
Yeah, and I want to get into, for example, the CDC, and I know that there was not only just political interference, but actual language that was inserted by the Trump political team into stuff that the CDC put out, and that stuff is being excised. Is that correct?
Yeah, that came out this week. Probably not a big surprise to your listeners.
Yep.
That was the case.
Yeah. Let's get into some of the most current stuff, one of which is, and we talked last night a little bit about the sort of the number one group that will not or is worried about taking or won't take the vaccine are Republicans, male Republicans who voted for Trump. Is that it?
Yeah, that's like 50% in many surveys say that, at least currently say that they don't plan to take the vaccine.
Okay, and that's a problem because we want herd immunity.
Because everybody should take the vaccine. It's good for them. It's good for their family. It's good for the country.
Now, Trump said earlier also, or within the last week, that he wants more credit for the vaccines. And we should give him, why not? I mean, he did finance, right? He did everything he could to help Operation Warp Speed, including that name, which Barron came up with. That's my theory.
look, if it helps for Republicans to know that the Democrats and Republicans have all been working on this effort together, if that is what persuades them to take the vaccine, it is in fact true. There are a lot of things that were done in the Trump administration or started that we're carrying on. Now, I don't think that that's actually how people, Democrat or Republican, but in particularly, it seems to be true of conservatives. I don't think that's how they make their decisions about the vaccine. They tend to be much more local, much less disbelieving of politicians, including Trump, by the way, in making decisions about taking the vaccine. So, people have been asking us, well, why don't you ask Donald Trump to do a PSA? And the answer is, I don't think he needs an engraved invitation to do a PSA. He can do a PSA if he wants to do a PSA. Probably should do a PSA. But I don't think that's the most important thing in moving the needle. I think the most important thing in moving the needle is something much more radical, which is just answering people's questions about the vaccine, because the results are so positive that if you just answer people's questions, I think more and more people will end up taking it.
I did think of a PSA, actually, which would be Biden and Trump together. And it'd start off with, hi, I'm President Joe Biden. I'm former President Donald Trump. We don't agree on a lot. For example, I think he stole the election. And he'd go, and I think that he should have been convicted in the impeachment. But we do agree on the vaccine. Think that would help?
I can't say for sure, that they'll do it, but I think if you pitch it the right way, maybe they will.
Okay, thanks. Well, you know, you're the senior advisor to the damn thing.
So you think if I have one shot to give President Biden some advice,
this would be it. Just tell him it was my idea.
Okay.
Mr. President, I know I don't have much of your time. Okay, well, you're saying that, like, telling them how effective this is. I know a lot of smart people, right? Most of my friends, almost all of my friends, if I say, okay, you know, the Pfizer vaccine is 95% effective. And they go, right. I go, do you know what that number means? And they don't. No one knows what that number means, really. I had Fauci on, and he explained it. I knew what it meant. But why don't you explain it, what that number means? And I think that if people knew that, it might make them more inclined to take the vaccine.
Well, if you have two groups of people, say your family and your wife's family, and one family, all of them took the vaccine, and let's say, you know, let's say Franny's family was the same size, your in-laws, and they didn't take the vaccine, there'd be 95% fewer cases on your side than on her side.
Infections. I think I can do it more effectively than you. Okay, this is what you're talking about, is a blind study, right? Is what you do when you test the
double blind studies. That's exactly right.
Double blind studies. So what you do is you have a placebo group and then the group that gets the shot, gets the vaccine, right? Okay. How many people are in those groups? How many were in the, say, the Pfizer study?
In the Pfizer study, there were about 30,000.
In each group?
In total.
In total, 15,000 each group.
Yeah.
Okay. The 95% means, effective means that only 5% of the number that got infected in the placebo group got infected. So it wasn't that 5% of the people who took the vaccine got the virus. It meant 5% of the percentage of the placebo group, right?
So you seriously think you did a better job than me?
No, but I thought I was going to do a better job than you when I started this. The difference is that number, that 95%, that 5%. People think, oh, I get it. 5% of us will get, even though we've gotten the vaccine, can get the virus and die. And the two things are, one, you won't get really sick and die. That's one, which is really important. And two, it's not 5% get the virus. It's 5% of the number in the placebo group.
You said something else that was really very important in there, which is that the really sick and die part, because they have what
that's a big part.
Yeah, yes. Well, they have what you call endpoints, okay, when they do these studies. An endpoint is just kind of what result are you looking for. One endpoint is called a mild end.
By the way, you are eating, aren't you?
Well, a little. I ate a little bit.
Okay. All right.
I'm also now I'm blushing.
Okay. But we can't, this is an audio medium.
Okay. So there's a 5% endpoint. There's three endpoints. There's a mild endpoint, which is, did I get a runny nose? Roughly speaking. There's a moderate endpoint, which is, did I get a fever? And then there's a severe endpoint, which is, did I get even sicker? And that sicker includes getting hospitalized or dying. In all three of the vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson, the Pfizer, and the Moderna, you had pretty much, after 30 days, a zero in terms of the number of people that actually got the severe endpoint, got sick, got hospitalized, and died. And that's on an absolute basis. Now, it doesn't mean that when you go from 30,000 to 300,000 or 3 million, that there won't be cases of people who do get very sick. But it does mean that there was an extraordinary result in these studies.
And I think that's maybe that will make people who are a little resistant anyway more likely to get it if they understand how unbelievably effective it is.
Right.
And that they not only have an incredibly small chance of getting infected, but they also have basically zero chance of getting so sick that they get hospitalized and die. They probably, thus far in the United States, right, no one has gotten, like, sick who's been inoculated.
We could be sitting here right now, think of it this way, we could be sitting here right now with no vaccine. And in fact, you know, it was probably a very likely case a year ago that we'd be sitting here now without a vaccine. So we're extraordinarily lucky. You know, the last administration called it a miracle. We call it good science. But whether you think it's a miracle or good science doesn't really matter. The fact is, here's something that I think is exclusive content for your listeners. It only works if you take it. So it's great, but you can't let it just sit there in the tube. You have to actually put it in your arm. And what's neat is it's messenger mRNA. It's just this tiny little set of instructions to tell your body what to do, and then the instructions disappear. So it's incredible science. What else is interesting and important, it turns out, is things like people are under the mistaken belief that this vaccine was rushed at warp speed. I don't know why they think that, but they think it was rushed at warp speed, and they don't like that. And the reality is that the mRNA technology was developed over a decade ago, and they had been investing in it in basic science, basically taxpayer dollars, and very smart people at the FDA and a place called BARDA and at the NIH, all places that you know you are personally responsible for getting funding to, by the way. They were taking those dollars and investing them in things like, hey, maybe this messenger RNA platform will someday come in handy. So this was a lot of foresight. So when they started to put this vaccine together at the beginning of last year, it wasn't, in fact, a rushed process. This was years and years of development in science. And it actually does help people to understand that because they understand that vaccines can't be developed in just a matter of months. And they're right. This wasn't developed in a matter of months.
Are these the first vaccines that were developed under the mRNA technology?
I believe they're the first vaccines to be in use. They were developing and have been developed using the platform to develop other vaccines. And here's the great news is this platform now is available to us if we invest in it. And thanks to Congress passing the American Rescue Plan, we now can invest in it. We can invest at scale in the capability to do mRNA vaccines even more rapidly than we did this time. And we can science the heck out of the next bug we see.
Including variants.
Including variants, exactly.
Which everyone now is talking about. Everyone's talking about these and are afraid of them and are afraid also that maybe one of these variants, like the South African variant, that these vaccines will not work on that. Okay, so let's talk about the boosters, right? Because that's what people are saying. Well, look, if we get a variant that is becoming a problem, we can give people boosters. Right. And that's that booster sounds like this is a booster, but that means you got to put it in people's arms, just like you had to put it in. We're hoping to have 250 million or 300 million people. It'll take a while, but you say it'll be done faster than next time.
Yeah. I think one of the questions we have is how often will you need to get another vaccine? And no one knows the answer to that question, but one good estimation might be maybe you need to get another vaccine every year. That's kind of a reasonable assumption. It may not be. It may be every 2 years. It may be every 3 years. And some of this depends on how good a job we do right now at vaccinating people and wearing masks to prevent the virus from continuing to mutate. Because if we do, and the mutation cycle is slower, because you can't mutate if you're not spreading, then in that case, you know, it could be every few years. If it starts to mutate faster and faster, if it has the right environment, then we could have to be vaccinated even more frequently than a year, although nobody's predicting that at this point. But yes, we've got to have factory capacity from my standpoint in terms of my job. I've got to make sure we have enough factory capacity and enough contracts with the vaccine manufacturers, and that they have scientific processes underway to allow them to test these boosters.
In the United States, the variants that we tend to have are from Great Britain and from Brazil. Is that correct?
Well, we have five what we call variants of interest. Three of them started overseas. Two of them started in the U.S. The two in the U.S., one is from New York. The other is from California. They're both coastal vaccines, so probably liberal. And then we have one from the U.K., one from South Africa, and one from Brazil. Those are the five what scientists have identified as variants of interest, because we've got lots of other variants, but they really don't concern us.
Okay, so which ones are most present, which are most dangerous?
So the one that's most concerning for us, certainly at the moment, is what they call B117. And B117 is the one that is also referred to as the UK variant, the one that was first spotted in the UK. The reason is it's because it's far more present in the US. It multiplies far more rapidly, so it's considered to be about 30% more contagious. And it also has a higher death rate as well. So maybe 30 to 40% higher death rate, although that's a little bit less certain. But that is, in many communities, that's already 25% of the COVID cases are B117. And it's different regionally. It's very present in Florida. We're now starting to see it in the Midwest and in other places. And it's predicted that by the time we get into April, the predominant virus in the U.S. will be B117. The good news about B117 is all the vaccines approved in the U.S. have been tested against this variant and have been demonstrated to be equally effective.
So basically all those variants that are in the U.S., but the South African one is the most concerning of the variants.
From a different perspective, people are concerned about the South African vaccine, and that is that the vaccines, when they were tested against the South African variant, they had a drop-off. They were still effective, but they were less effective.
What does that mean? That means you got slightly sicker? Or does that mean...
I'm going to try to explain this in a visual way. You know, let's say that you're in an office building and there's a giant flood. And the vaccine works like an elevator. It takes you up to the 20th floor. And the flood waters reach up to, like, say, the 6th floor. So you're well above the flood and you're fine. Now, with the South African variant, the elevator doesn't take you quite as high. It only takes you to, say, the 8th floor. So the good news is it gives you some immune response, but it gives you less immune response. Fortunately, it appears to give you enough to get over the threshold, which is why I use that water in the building analogy, because there is a point at which it really matters. And you could imagine if there was a variant that fooled the vaccine even further, where the vaccine would only take you to the 4th floor or the 5th floor. But it is less effective because it doesn't create quite as many antibodies, but it still appears to be over the threshold.
So you would not be in danger of getting really sick and dying, which I heard you on In the Bubble, by the way, your podcast that you've, you know, obviously had to give up. And you have Bob, what is it, Bob Wachter?
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. who is an actual doctor.
Right, an actual doctor.
Who is hosting it now. And he asked you about what can people do in that, you know, now. And you said live. And to me, taking the vaccine, the first thing I thought of, oh, my God, I'm going to live. Yeah. So that's one.
Yeah.
And then the two is not get so sick that you will have, you know, after effects for the rest of your life.
Well, yes. So I'm going to explain that answer a little bit. I also meant not die. I meant survive. But the reason I gave that answer, which I know sounds very glib, and I don't want it to be misinterpreted, is that we were getting asked very frequently, you need to tell people why they should take the vaccine. What they, in other words, tell them that they can go, you know, to a concert or this or that. Otherwise, people won't have the incentive to take the vaccine. And, you know, it's a very reasonable question. People want to know, hey, if I get vaccinated, what is safe to do? So but we hadn't yet seen guidance from the CDC, because the CDC was at that point still studying the question. They've since come out with some guidance, but at that point they hadn't. And so I was being asked, well, why you have to give people an incentive to take the vaccine. And I said, I think they have an incentive to take the vaccine. And the same reason you take the measles vaccine and the mumps vaccine and you know, the polio vaccine. You want to live. And I don't want, you know, I appreciate you bringing it up, because I don't want to forget. I don't want people to forget that and how important that is. But I recognize that it's also true that people want to get back to the things in their life that they value. And that guidance is very important.
And the president brought this up in his speech the other day. And he talked about the 4th of July. And he was saying that hopefully by the 4th of July, people will be able to get together in your backyard and do a barbecue. And that's what people are looking forward to as well, right?
Yeah. And they're probably going to do it regardless of whether we get there or not. So we have to get there, because I think people are, apropos this weekend, flying around for spring break and so on. But one of the things that's nice, and I think that it's nice that the CDC started this way, and I know that this is important to you, it's important to me personally as well, is what I just think of it as the hugging guidance, which is most people wanted to know, can I hug my grandparents? Can I hug my parents? Can I hug my grandchildren? Can I hug my kids? You know, if I've gotten the vaccine, and they haven't. And that was the first, I think very appropriately, that was the first bit of guidance the CDC released, which said, yes, if one party has been vaccinated, even if the other party hasn't, so long as that person who hasn't been vaccinated isn't high risk for some reason, then you can be indoors without a mask, and indeed you can hug if you're going to be inclined to hug. And so that was pretty
neat. That's a big, big, big deal.
I think it's pretty neat. The things that I know, I can tell you, the things that I didn't appreciate or give as much appreciation to in life as I now do, you know, seeing the people I love, and, you know, touching people, your family, your kids, your grandkids, being able to do that again, that just feels like we are starting to get back the most important things.
And we will get there. And hopefully we will all get there. But that, you know, part of that depends on the people who are reticent to taking it, enough of them anyway. What does give us the kind of immunity that we need, the herd immunity that we need? What percentage of Americans would have to take the thing?
Well, so this Tony Fauci estimate is 70 to 85% is the percentage that he says gets to herd immunity. And I think part of the reason it's not precise is with a more highly contagious variant, you would need to get to a higher level of herd immunity. You'd need a higher level of people vaccinated.
And what Texas did and what Mississippi did is not helpful at all. How is that going to affect this?
Not positively. I mean, look, we don't know, and I don't want to be so arrogant as to say that I predict that because of that, something bad's going to happen. I will be bold enough to say that because of that, nothing good is going to happen. Put aside the opening of the businesses, because we all have a lot of sympathy for businesses that have had to be closed. But the cost of wearing a mask feels to me so little that to wear a mask for the next couple of months to give yourself a higher likelihood that we can turn the corner and not have to look back feels like a very, very low cost.
It's an insane thing not to do. And the incidence of flu and colds has shot down, right? Because people wear masks.
It's been like zero.
It might be smart just to wear a mask from now on, you know, when you're in crowded areas.
As we all know, there's parts of the world that do and have for quite a while. And I will admit to thinking that was strange. I don't know why I thought it was strange.
I did too. I'd be at LAX and I'd see a plane load of folks get off from somewhere in Asia and they'd be wearing the mask. And I go, these people, boy, they were smart.
Yeah. I mean, you've had like something like 100 deaths in total in Hong Kong, if even that, obviously.
From COVID.
Right, from COVID. And it's obviously very close. It's much closer than we are to the source of the disease.
Well, speaking of which, I want to ask you about this. We've done a terrible job. I mean, in terms of we're now, 530-some thousand souls have passed. But the rest of the world has done, like Asia especially, but why did they do so much better than we did?
So I don't think we know the entire story, but there are a couple things that I think we know are at least partially to credit. One is just simply past experience with infectious diseases. We were, and we, I think, behaved like people who never believed that an infectious disease could possibly come to our shores and acted in a way that most of the rest of the world, particularly people who had seen infectious diseases before, like Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, did not react. And so that was one of the things that cost us. And if you look at countries around the world, those that have had experience with infectious diseases tend to do better. The second, and this is a soft measure, so you can decide how you want to measure it, is countries that have more of a collective societal mentality as opposed to one that just emphasizes individual freedom, liberty, wealth, and have much more unequal societies. The unequal societies, Brazil, the US, Russia, where there's high amounts of income inequality and less kind of a social norm, didn't do as well. Because what has to happen, of course, is that people, even if they don't feel personally at risk, still take precautions in those countries because they're looking out for each other. So that's I think, the second thing. Now, there may be other factors.
That's a sad commentary on us because we've come together. World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness, people came together.
We're a couple generations from that kind of sacrifice. Yep. You know, my I think about when you say that, I think about my grandmother who came to the country in 1910, fled a very bad situation in Europe, lost a lot of brothers and sisters, had like lived through a 10-year depression and a 6-year world war. And, you know, I think if she looked at me right now and looked at our society, she'd say, oh my God, you guys can't wear a mask for 4 weeks in a row. And, you know, I went without hot food for like years. I think that like we have probably, you know, our generations are probably not as, we don't have that sort of shared sacrifice. We got it in our genes, we got it in our lineage, but I don't think we really would have made my grandmother proud.
And I hate to put politics into it, but if you look at who, as we started this conversation, who's resisting this, there is a sort of a different kind of philosophy in terms of we're all in this together between maybe us Democrats and those Republicans.
You know, I was on Hugh Hewitt's radio program, and as I think most people listening know, a conservative radio show, and he's very pro-vaccine. And, you know, we talked about this idea in conservative communities that they don't care about their neighbors is one that they said isn't true. And I believe that. I mean, I don't think I've ever been to a community where people don't care about their neighbors. But, you know, it did become a sort of, well, more than sort of, we all observed this. It became kind of a tribal identifier, whether you'd wear a mask or not.
And that Trump must bear a lot of responsibility for that. Because he easily could have just worn the damn mask and said, everybody wear the mask.
I wonder how things might have been different.
Yeah, because that became political because of that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I would say now my job is as much as possible, and you can hear it in the way I'm talking, which may be different than the last time I was on your program, is not to emphasize these differences quite as much, because I want to be careful that this idea of taking a vaccine doesn't also turn into a tribal decision, and that people understand that these are not, should not be politicized. And so I think President Biden is trying very hard to send the message that, guys, let's just take the politics out of this. You can fight with me about other stuff, but this shouldn't be one of them. You know, it's a dangerous game to play for any of us to, in an infectious disease, to kind of say, yes, this half will, this half won't. That's a very strange place to be.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Andy Slavitt right after this. We're back with Andy Slavitt. What is the new normal going to look like going, like, say, in the fall? What's going to be the new normal in this country in terms of, okay, everyone is going to be vaccinated. We've really hit close to herd immunity or herd immunity. What's life going to be like? How's it going to be different than it was? How's it going to be the same?
So, look, I think if we do a great job and really pull together, take the vaccine, stay with public health measures for as long as we can, We could have a pretty, I'll say, normal summer, camp, sports, et cetera, et cetera. I'm quite confident that school can begin on time next fall in person with plenty of the amenities, sports and otherwise. Now, there will be communities around the country where they maybe have low vaccination rates. And in those communities, you know, there may be things will be more cautious. And I think there will certainly be occasional flare-ups. But if we have good testing, good antivirals, continue to boost with the vaccines, we manage the variants, those can be exceptions. They don't have to dominate our lives. You know, will we have full football stadiums? Maybe not at the beginning of the season. Maybe at the beginning of the season, at some point during the season, probably. Will people go to rock concerts? Rap concerts, cello concerts, probably only cello concerts of those three. No.
Well, those are usually more sparse.
Sparse, right. Yes, exactly. Attended. We're going to build our way up the Rolling Stones concerts.
Speaking of this, I would just want, what about an immunity passport kind of thing? Like, if you've gotten, like, okay, we'll let you in if you can show us your vaccination thing.
So
is that tenable? Can you do that in America?
Well, so in Israel, they have something called the Green Pass, which the government has issued, and you really need it to go places. Now, I don't think that's what will happen in the U.S. I think what will happen in the U.S. is there will be certain things, very likely, not driven by the government, but driven by, say, a cruise ship or a concert or maybe going to a place of business or going to a school where if you show a credential of sorts, probably like an RFID code that they will have you, you know, you're able to enter. And if you don't, maybe that, you know, you can't. The cruise lines that have begun to operate, not in the U.S., but they're operating in different parts of the world, they're vaccine-only cruises. You have to have a vaccine in order to take the cruise. So, you know, I suspect this will evolve. I suspect there will be strong feelings about this. I suspect there will be potential legal questions and issues. You know, our view, and I spoke about this at a press conference, is that that will not be a place where government will intervene, but it'll be a place where the private sector and nonprofit groups will. And that if there are credentials, that we think they ought to be free, they ought to be available both digitally and in paper, they ought to be available in multiple languages, they ought to be private, and they ought to be secure. And if they have those features, then that's the kind of thing that we think is appropriate.
It might be an interesting, it might be a good incentive for people to get inoculated.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's likely, you know, it'll likely be part of the landscape. Although, again, you know, I don't want that to be interpreted as the government thinks that that's a good idea, because that's not, I don't think that's the right message.
Right. Yeah. I think that's smart. I think you're being smart, which is a good quality in what you're doing. I think that's important. Speaking of smart, you told me something about Fauci named one of the sexiest men. Is it? Did I hear that from you?
Fauci, sexiest.
Or did you just hear it from Fauci?
Yeah. he was named one of the sexiest men alive. Yes, he was named one of the sexiest men alive. And let me.
By whom?
People Magazine.
By People Magazine.
People Magazine. It actually, he was nominated, but apparently he lost to someone named Michael B. Jordan, who I don't know is nearly as sexy as Anthony Fauci. I mean, I will say that it's really gone to his head. he's a different person. He dresses differently, talks differently. He was definitely named one of the sexiest men alive. That is true.
Yeah, he's certainly the sexiest 80-year-old guy, don't you think?
I've always felt funny calling him sexy, just because I just feel that's a weird thing to do. So yeah, the ice was broken.
Because you work together.
It's awkward for him. It's awkward for me. I also think he probably thinks that I should have gotten it. And that's awkward.
I know Lana believes that.
No, she voted for Fauci, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure she did. Speaking of your family, when I was on In the Bubble, I was very complimentary of your son, Zach.
You were very nice to Zach.
And I meant it. And what I liked, Zach had the job on the show of finding stuff, finding facts, finding interesting stuff, right? And reporting on it. And what I liked about the way Zach did it, how old was he at the time? 17, 18?
He was 18.
18. He did not try to be anything other than himself and an 18-year-old. You know, there's this thing about, I don't really care about clothes very much. You may know that. The reason I bring this up is that it's, if you really care about clothes or you don't care about clothes at all, that's the best place to be at if about clothes.
Right.
And so I think I put Zach in the category of not caring at all about how he was coming off.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so great. Like Brian Williams, who I consider a great broadcaster, and is charming and witty and great in serious stuff, and obviously someone who wants to be that way and cares about being that way and revels in it, and that's great. Zach is doesn't. And he was fantastic on your podcast.
He could not have sounded more bored, because he could not have been more bored, as it turns out. Chelsea Clinton comes on the program, and I think that Zach, in the clothes analogy, is the equivalent of, he's going to at least wear khakis, right? He's at least going to wear a button-down shirt in the clothes analogy you're making. Mm-hmm. Zach showed up in the equivalent of like swim trunks. So I said, hey, Zach, let me introduce you to Chelsea Clinton. Oh, hi, Zach. So great to meet you. So Zach said,
I should introduce my 18-year-old son, who is my co-host on the show, Zach. Zach, can you say hi to Chelsea Clinton?
Hey.
Oh, hi, Zach.
That's 18-year-old for hi.
Yeah.
It's funny because you think you are an incredibly accomplished person. Look, you're whatever you are on the task force. I can't, you don't have a senior advisor, and you saved Obamacare. We've gone through that before. And you would think that most people who like that level of achievement would have children who feel some need. And I just think it speaks worlds of you and Lana that he is the way he is.
It turned out that what he wanted was to do stuff 18-year-olds do. And he did. And he did not want.
He couldn't. And he couldn't, because it was
right.
The whole point of in the bubble was
to do stuff.
He's in your bubble.
Yeah, exactly. What he did not want is to do stuff that grown-ups think 18-year-olds should think are very cool. Like, he had no interest in that. He wanted to do stuff that 18-year-olds did. And I couldn't for a long time figure out why he was so bored. And
unexcited about being the researcher and on-air presence for one of the experts in the country on COVID during the COVID crisis.
I would even enjoy that. It, you know, at the very least, you know, something for his college resume, perhaps. But he says, well, I don't think I'm going to put that on my college application. And I said, really, Zach? He's like, yeah. I don't know.
Well, wait a minute. I'm not even going to include that, because that makes him sound kind of stupid.
Well, he did. He did ultimately put it. He did ultimately put it down. But he kind of, like, it didn't occur to him, like, when he was filling out his application. It was, that's how meaningless involved in the program was to, like, in his mind, like, the phone call he got from a girl that night was for 10 minutes. Was like 1,000 times more important than.
Of course. Of course. Of course. Of course.
I guess, of course, but I didn't figure it out for a long time.
Well, you were 18 once, but congratulations and thank you. Thank you. You guys, I feel very, very good about the job you guys are doing. I know that you don't take any victory laps at all until this is all over. But, and I think that people have a lot of confidence now that you guys are at least doing the best you can, and you're not going to be perfect. You're going to make mistakes, but also that you will admit it when you've made mistakes.
I really appreciate you saying that. I really hope that people feel like they're getting the truth from us, that we are making an effort. I will say that I know what people have been through in this country, the trauma, the anxiety, the loss. And I think that the president doesn't expect us to have a good night's sleep until people are safer again. Whether the answer, whether that is, you know, back to normal, or whether that is just in a much, much lower risk environment so that everyone can get back to the things in their life that they really value and the people that they really value. You know, for the period of time that I'm here, and I'm only here for about 4.5 months.
Is it possible that you might extend that?
I'm going to say the answer to that is no. I also don't think I will need to, because at the end of May, while we won't be all done, by the time I leave, I think we're going to be in a position where the things that really need to be in place to make the rest of this conclude successfully will hopefully be there. It doesn't mean there won't be any more curveballs, but it means we'll be ready for them. And I would also, it's very important that I say, I am not by any means the critical piece of this. I'm part of a team of great people who are, I think, going to be more than capable of continuing to do the things that they're already doing.
Well, I'm very, very impressed with the team. And Rochelle Walensky is what a great head of the CDC. President really has put together a terrific team. And thank you all for the hard. I know you guys are working night and day. And it's just so heartening that your guys are doing this work. And I'm very grateful for that.
It's a privilege.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.